It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says we're overusing our Social Security numbers as a form of identification, and that's making us more vulnerable to identity theft.
First Forestry has been a huge job generator in Wisconsin for over a century. Jobs in logging, lumber, and papermaking are all rooted in sustainable forestry. But over the last decade, several challenges to this industry have cropped up, and the consequences for forests in Wisconsin have yet to be determined.
We'll be speaking with John Schmid soon. He's been covering forestry issues in Wisconsin, and he's here to talk about these challenges and how they may change the state's economy. He's an economics writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. One of the issues that he's been looking at is the transfer of forested land from one generation to the next. Often the younger generation is no longer in state and may not have an interest in maintaining the timberland, and that means that Wisconsin will be losing a lot of its forest cover. That forest and the renewable process of keeping it going has been key to many industries in Wisconsin, but because of the lack of paper mills that are still in the state, we are not able to continue supporting that sustainable agriculture. We are actually going to go right now to a segment that Veronica Rickert is hosting.
That's right. High-profile cyber attacks are a regular part of the news in recent months. Many of those attacks target our personal data. They target names, phone numbers, credit card information, and Social Security numbers. And it's the Social Security information that has our next guest worried. She writes that those numbers are a prized part of the data honeypot sought by hackers. But it shouldn't be that way, she says, because companies and the government are using Social Security numbers in ways that they were never supposed to be used. Farai Chidea joins us now. She's a reporter, political and culture analyst and educator, and a senior writer for 538, where she wrote about Social Security numbers and identity theft. Farai, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
How are companies using Social Security numbers in ways that make them vulnerable for fraud and identity theft?
Well, I think that one example of a company that got burned by the way it uses Social Security numbers is AT&T, which happens to be my wireless provider. And so I got a notice saying that they wanted to stop using the last four digits of my social to verify who I was when I called in or logged in, and they wanted me to create a separate kind of login password. And that is in part because they had a huge security breach where they had to pay a $25 million settlement after their own employees at remote call centers were using Social Security numbers of clients to then crack cell phones, which is a big business, particularly, I mean, in the U.S., but particularly abroad. So basically, the problem is when you use the social, and a lot of companies use the last four digits of the social to verify who someone is, you are using information that exists in other places. So if you are someone who's a hacker, you can probably find ways that people have their social documented, and then you can use that to log into all their accounts. I mean, I have a friend who just sent an email to his friend saying, yeah, we lost, you know, on paper $25,000.
Wow.
And we are devastated, except that we know we'll get all of it back, but it's a huge pain to document this. But basically, once someone had gotten their social and used that as an authenticator, this is the thing. The Social Security number can either be used as, you know, the equivalent of an email, you know, sort of like this is who this person, you know, is on a sort of like very basic level, but it can be used as an authenticator, which is much more important. And if you use an authenticator like a Social Security number, it's like using a password that's the same as your email, and that's a problem.
Well, and using Social Security numbers, this is not a new thing. Lots of companies do this now. So how do we wean ourselves away from that now?
Well, a lot of security companies are saying that, you know, companies have to protect themselves and their own liability by switching away from using Social Security numbers as authenticators, telling their customers, anyone who asks for their social, they are not us. they are somebody who's trying to hack you. Do not give out your social. The problem is the vast majority of companies, 80%+ of banks and financial institutions are still using this as an authenticator. So right now, companies, by and large, are still using this to allow people to, you know, it's the equivalent of a password for many companies. But I think companies, when you start losing millions or even billions of dollars to fraud, you're like, wait a minute, you know, we might have to rethink this.
And does this affect government agencies and their data practices, too?
Yeah, you can talk to the IRS, which paid out over $5 billion with a B to people who were not who they said they were, who filed false tax returns using Social Security numbers that they had hacked and you know, appropriated from other people. I happened to interview a couple of people who, you know, in one case, a man who tried to file his taxes and found out that he in quotes, had already gotten a refund, and it wasn't him at all. In another case, someone got a big check at their house, and it was because the fraudster had tried to get it deposited to an online account, and it was they weren't sophisticated enough to get the money delivered to the account, but still, the check went through, and he went home, and he was like, what's this? You know, it's like there's this check, this refund that and it had nothing to do with him except that the U.S. government had cut that check. So $5 billion, $5.6 billion.
We're talking to Faraicha Dea right now about Social Security numbers and identity theft. And speaking of the government, you did talk to a government official who's working on this problem. His name is Mike Garcia, who said that even passwords are eminently hackable and that what we really need is a marketplace where the password is essentially dead. So what takes the place of the password if we're not even using Social Security numbers or passwords? What comes next?
Well, let me just say that he's speaking from the perspective of someone who's really advanced in cybersecurity, and what he's talking about will happen eventually. I don't personally think it will happen anytime soon, but there are ways to use, like, for example, I use a double sign-in to get onto my Gmail. And I have to have a number that is sent to my cell phone, either through text or through a little app. And I don't just have to enter my password. I also have to use my phone to get this number and enter it into the computer. So it knows that the person, it's not infallible, but it's pretty good because the person who has the cell phone has to be the one who knows the password and gets the code. And so there's systems evolving that involve cyber keys and encryption, and there are ways to use little devices that you can, like, have on literally your keychain, your physical keychain, so little things you plug in to your computer that have a bunch of codes. There are things like LastPass, which allow you to create incredibly – LastPass is a sort of software device that allows you to create these incredibly complex passwords that you don't have to remember because it remembers all of them for you. And once you sign into LastPass and you create these complex passwords, it remembers them. And so you're still using passwords, but, you know, you can enter a 15-digit, you know, password with all sorts of weird characters in it that you're never going to remember on a personal level unless you're one of those people who has a photographic memory. So nothing is infallible, but there are things that are developing that allow you to use software encryption, cyber keys. The problem is that most people aren't there yet, and most companies aren't there yet. It's not like companies are begging people to use cyber keys, but it just depends on how much money people keep losing, individuals and corporations, and I think that will change the game.
Given all the data that's already out there right now, what do you think individuals can do to protect their Social Security number data?
Well, first of all, I mean, I have been in the past very cavalier. Like when someone would say, oh, can you send me your social because I need it for this document, I would just email it to them. Now I'm like, well, I'm going to email you the first three, you know, to five digits of my social, and then I will text you the rest of it. So I break up the communication, so not all of it is in one place. That's not perfect, but it's a way around some of the hazards of basically having your social security number floating all through your email account, because if someone ever hacks into your email account and they find an email that lists your social security number, well, game up. And so there's things like that. You know, and paper is beautiful. I mean, when I work with other people, I sometimes hire people to help me with administrative tasks, and I give them a paper sheet. They're trustworthy people, and I'm like, this is a paper sheet with my social security number, you know, all of this other login information, and you have to work off of this paper sheet, and you have to protect it, and you are under no circumstances to enter it into a computer system. So it's awkward. You know, the whole point of computers is to make life easier, but sometimes easy is too easy.
So for just briefly, as we wrap up, do you ever see legislation coming that would maybe make it illegal for companies to ask to use part of your social security number?
Some people are advocating for that. I mean, I talked to an information scientist who's done a lot of research on this, and he has advocated basically that there is top-down legislation. Other people think that that's too restrictive and too, you know, a lot of people don't like the government, you know, getting too deeply into the world of business. But I think businesses, whether or not the government tells them to do it through legislation, businesses are realizing this is a huge liability. But yes, there could be federal legislation. Right now, none is pending. There's other legislation pending to deal specifically with the hacks at the IRS and other forms of cybersecurity, but there's nothing saying let's forbid, you know, private companies from using the social as an authenticator.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Farai Chidea, senior writer for 538, talking about social security numbers and identity theft. Forestry has been a pillar of the job industry in Wisconsin for over a century. There are jobs in logging, lumber, and papermaking, all rooted in sustainable forestry. But over the last several decades, the challenges to this industry have cropped up, and the consequences for forests in Wisconsin have yet to be determined.
John Schmidt has been covering forestry issues in Wisconsin, and he's here to talk about these challenges and how they may change the state's economy. He's an economics writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for inviting me here.
So how significant is forestry in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's such an interesting, almost counterintuitive kind of question, because it's such a quiet, organic, kind of anonymous industry, and the nature of something that's quiet and anonymous is so at odds with an industry that is so enormous, that has so much scope and scale to it. It's kind of unrecognized. You could start with jobs. These are the industries you mentioned. These are the oldest and to this day collectively the biggest sector of the state economy. You know, it's more than logging and lumber and furniture making. You're talking about pulp, paper making, and an astonishingly huge sister industry of printing the nation's books and magazines and catalogs. All of these are quintessential Wisconsin industries. You know, to this day, you're talking about tens of thousands of jobs in these industries. Somewhat ominously, you know, ink on paper. It sort of evokes a feeling of the fin de siècle, that these days are numbered for these industries, but still huge. But it's important for other reasons as well. By feeding and fueling and sustaining and reforesting the state, you've created recreation opportunities. Let's face it, Wisconsin is prime area for cross-country skiers, hunters, snowmobilers. There's a lot of that. The history of the state's economy is written in the forestry. But to my mind, if you want to talk about the importance of this, Wisconsin created a model of sustainable forestry. We live in a time when so many industries wish so much to be called sustainable or have the label of green applied to them. Well, Wisconsin did that on a grand scale very successfully in the last century, long before anyone talked about making it popular.
Mm-hmm. So what have been some of the challenges to that balance of industry and the sustainable forestry? You mentioned the move away from ink on paper printing. Is that one of the major challenges to the industry now?
I would have to say so. I see this all through a certain prism. What's at stake here, and what I wrote about in Sunday's paper, which anyone can go find at jsonline.com, that's our website, is a model, what I called an economic ecosystem. It's a phenomenon. It's something the likes of which I've never seen in any of the economics reporting or the globalization reporting I've done anywhere else. You know, it's a model where you have economics, which effectively marries economics and ecology, man and nature, job creation, quality of life, recreation, and trees, tree huggers and barons of industry together. So you created this model. The model worked as long as there was markets for the cellulose, as long as there was trees to pulp into paper, or as long as there was hardwoods to make into basketball floors or IKEA furniture or bookshelves or what have you. Those are all classic Wisconsin industries. That model is unraveling in its classic form. The model that was, you know, that's so interesting to look at in the light of, you know, modern economics. You have to really start with paper. The paper industry is here because it's been here for 150 years. They were the ones that took the lead on reforesting the state because the state was truly clear cut.
Well, and one of the impacts right now is that because of globalization, it can actually be cheaper to make these wood and paper products from wood that's being shipped from around the world than from 20 miles down the road. How has that happened?
That's fascinating, isn't it? It is much more than an environmental story. You know, you may love trees and you may love that they're carbon sponges, but there's a lot of globalization forces at play here in this industry. So Wisconsin, let's face it, is a cold state. It's the northern half of the state where you have the most forests. Many people don't know this, but fully half of the state, half of the acreage of the state of Wisconsin is covered in forests. That's bigger than the state of Vermont. And they even call them industrial forests quite often, or working forests, just because they're like a crop. Those crop cycles are interrupted once a year with these brutal winters that slow the growing cycles of these trees. Go down to Southeast Asia, go to Brazil, South America, and you can grow a tree in half the time or faster than it takes in Wisconsin. As a result, you can have, you know, very aggressive tree plantations in those, even in the southern United States. That's where you get the economies that allow you to ship barges of pulp up to Wisconsin, and you can make paper in a Wisconsin mill out of pulp that's grown halfway around the world. It's a very interesting aspect of globalization.
So we're talking about these large issues of global trade. Now let's take it down to a much, much smaller landscape and families and intergenerational transfer of this forested land in Wisconsin. What's happening with that forested land that is going to be passing from an older generation who maybe was very, very intimately involved in managing that land to the next generation?
Well, this is Wisconsin Public Radio, so the audience that's listening to this show probably knows pretty well what a lot of people who are urban dwellers don't. Wisconsin has this very interesting culture of families that own family-owned tree farms, tree plantations, or woodlands, or timberlands, whatever you want to call them. When you look at the 17 million acres of Wisconsin, again, that's half the state that's covered in forestry, some 10 million of it, you know, the vast preponderance of it is owned by families. These are smaller lots. Now, that's been a long time tradition. Wisconsinites love planting trees, and they love spending time in the trees in the forest land. But just as you have the graying of America, just as you have the echo of the baby boom that's dying out and changing the nature of society, that's being reflected in forest ownership as well. if you grew up in a family that own these timberlands, but you may have moved to San Diego, become a doctor, and started a family there, and then, lo, your parents call you up and say, hey, guess what? You just inherited the management of 200 acres of forest land. You're thinking, oh, great. I have to go over there and spend time. I have to, you know, comply with, you know, the various state regulations on that. So some would say, well, now it's less of a place where I love the land and have a land ethic, and more of a just an asset that maybe I can just liquidate.
And actually, there are institutional investors and portfolio managers who are buying that forest land. Isn't that a good thing overall, or are there downsides to that?
Well, that's where you get a very possibly the clearest example of a change in the business model or the economic ecosystem that's been that's grown up in Wisconsin. It's true what you just said. Of the this gets away from the notion of family ownership. The paper mills themselves, as they were creating the model of sustainable forestry in Wisconsin, they owned their own timberlands. That was the common model. Wisconsin, by the way, is the biggest paper-making state in the country to this day, and so it was common for paper mills to have their own timberlands just to grow and have a guaranteed supply of pulp. Well,
and John, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry. John Schmidt, economics writer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, reports on the Wisconsin timber industry.
This afternoon, the Assembly Judiciary Committee held a public hearing at the state capitol on a bill to revoke the licenses of repeat drunk drivers for at least 10 years. Joining us to talk about that proposal in the hearing is Senator Van Wongerd, co-sponsor of the bill in the Senate. Senator Wongerd, thank you for joining us.
Well, good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you. Well, currently the DOT can revoke licenses of OWI offenders for up to a year. Now, your proposal would permanently revoke the licenses of those with five or more drunk driving convictions. I understand they can reapply after 10 years, but why do you feel that this stricter penalty is needed?
Well, obviously, when people are operating vehicles after their third, fourth, fifth, ninth offense, they haven't learned that they cannot operate a motor vehicle. This would send a clear message that operation of a motor vehicle by that individual is not permitted. And by revoking it for a 10-year period, I mean, it's clear that that person should not be behind the wheel of a car operating. So that's the reasoning behind it. It's got to be a severe enough penalty that they get the hint that they're not going to be eligible for a license for up to that 10-year period.
And tell us how else the law would work. There are different gradations in terms of the severity. Can you lay that out for us?
Well, first of all, you know, this is, we call this the five strikes bill, but it's like, actually, if you have three OWIs and you also have two other traffic-related issues that are criminal, say, hit and run causing injury would be one of those qualifiers. That would qualify the same as if it was a drunk driving. So if you had two of those would count to get you to the number five. And, of course, this is, you know, they're counting those over your lifetime. And that's the reasoning for having the five strikes.
A Gannett, Wisconsin media investigative team reported earlier this fall that more than 800 motorists were convicted of their fifth or greater OWI offenses for the previous 2 years. Do you think that this bill would significantly reduce that trend?
I absolutely do, because what this bill does is this bill, number one, puts some teeth behind the revocation process. Their license will be revoked permanently for that 10-year period. They'll be eligible after that 10 years of revocation to reapply, but then only if they haven't been involved in some other criminal conduct. And then only after they go through alcohol assessment and they have a driver safety plan in place. And, of course, they're going to have, by having a driver safety plan, that's insurance, the whole nine yards, before they would be eligible to be able to operate. So they'd go through the alcohol assessment, they'd go through the psychological services to determine that, in fact, they are compliant.
Now, some advocates of tougher OWI legislation say five strikes is too many strikes and that this bill doesn't really go far enough toward curbing offenses like this. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say this. Right now, we have people that are offending 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 times. And it I think, has to do, you know, part of this is a psychological thing, too, where some of these individuals don't think that there's enough of a penalty here. So as an example, we have the ignition interlock bell, which the IID designation going from requiring an individual to have an ignition interlock on their vehicle that they might be driving. So it's attached to a specific vehicle. We have legislation that we have pending right now that will change that, and it will designate the individual to be an IID, somebody who has to have an ignition interlock when they're driving any vehicle. And then it makes it a criminal offense if they violate that IID indicator on their driver's license. So if they go and drive and they have this on their license and they're driving and it does not have an interlock device, that's now a criminal offense, or it will be a criminal offense. Same thing with this five strikes and you're out. We're stretching this over a person's lifetime, you know. So I'm not sure that five is the best number, but it's a great start from where we're at. And the other part of the issue is that we can hopefully get people compliant or more compliant because of what has been also put into the consequences for a person violating this law. So first offense, after if you're revoked and you're under the revocation process and you get tagged again, you're going to have a $2,500 cash fine and up to 1 year in jail. You have a second or subsequent violation, it's now going to be a $10,000 fine, and another year you're going to jail. So it's taken this thing out of where they are just, you know, slapped on the hand and they're put back out and they continue to drive. You know, alcoholism is a really serious disease, and it's an addiction, and we need to deal with some of those issues also. But there are just some people that they just can't handle that because they have not bottomed out, and they haven't made the decision to not drink because they have an addiction. So sometimes those people need to be secured in the locked facility because they just don't know what it is to be responsible.
We're talking with Senator Wongard right now, co-sponsor of the Five Strikes OWI bill in the Wisconsin State Senate right now. And Senator Wongard, what kind of support do you have in the legislature for this bill?
Well, we have bipartisan support from both sides of the aisle with the bill. I think that, you know, we're looking at doing several different things currently to reduce the potential for people reoffending. And, you know, it's not just one thing that's going to be a silver bullet. This is an issue that we're trying to deal with. And it's not just alcohol-related issues. You know, we have individuals that are self-medicating with prescription drugs and consuming intoxicants also, not to mention the fact that we have a heroin epidemic. So when you start mixing and matching and self-medicating, you know, there's other outlying issues that cause a problem and cause this issue to happen. But if people think that they can get behind the wheel, driving is not a right. Driving is a privilege. And when you operate that motor vehicle, you have a duty and a responsibility to operate it, you know, safely. And I think that this legislation that we heard in the Assembly Judiciary Committee this afternoon, I think this is a great start to that. We already have some pretty tough laws here in Wisconsin. You will hear people say that we don't have a real tough approach to alcohol-related issues, but I would disagree. And they will say that because we don't make first offense a felony. What a lot of these other states do is they make the first offense a felony. And then after people go through and jump through some hoops, then they might take and reduce it down to a misdemeanor. But that individual that's had the first offense, maybe they went to a wedding and consumed one glass of champagne, well, probably more than that unless you're a really little person. But if they have a few glasses of champagne, they go out and they drive, they get tagged for drunk driving for a first offense. We found that by having first offense as a civil forfeiture, we get them plugged into the system so that they have, they're directed to psychological services for evaluation on whether or not it's irresponsible use or there's actually an addiction issue that needs to be addressed. And before they're able to have their license back, they have to meet, go through those processes, pay the fees, and they have to go through a period of revocation. They have to have insurance. So we go through and require all those things, and not to mention a pretty healthy fine. And we find that about 70% of those individuals do not reoffend.
I want to ask you a question about something you just said there. You said that this was a start, and you also said we have some pretty tough legislation on the books, but it has also been tough getting new OWI bills passed in the legislature over the past several years. Do you consider this bill an end in itself, or do you consider this, in essence, a start at reforming?
Well, first of all, I left the Senate for a couple years, as you recall. If I would not have been recalled, this legislation would have already been on the books. I have a law enforcement background. I'm an expert in dealing with alcohol issues as a traffic investigator for almost 25 years of my 30-year law enforcement career, accident reconstructionist. I taught alcohol-related issues to police departments and law enforcement agencies, etc. So this has been a passion of my life, you know, that I have worked to deal with these kinds of issues. I worked with AA and Al-Anon and Alateen in my community because I see this as an issue. I think this is a good start. We have to work at changing people's behaviors. And that's the other issue. You know, we have to make sure that people understand the responsibility when they get behind the wheel of a car and they have been consuming intoxicants. That is not good. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, we used to find out that the individual that was the real heavy drinker that really got intoxicated, that usually was not the individual that would cause the most issues because they knew they were drunk. The problem oftentimes is the one that gets around the 1-0 or the 1-5 that thinks that they drive better because they got a few drinks under their belt. And so we need to educate people to their responsibility and that this is a privilege and just the devastating effects that it can have on the individual offender's lives. But God forbid you're involved in a traffic crash and somebody loses their life. We heard those stories today in testimony with individuals that lost their life, parents that lost their child. This isn't acceptable. We lose one person to a drunk driver, that's too many. So when I say this is a great start, until we totally eliminate people operating vehicles under the influence of intoxicants and drugs, there's always going to be more we can do.
Senator Wongert, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for the invitation. Have a great Thanksgiving, and remember, don't drink and drive.
That was Van Wongert, a Republican senator in the Wisconsin legislature. He's co-sponsor of a proposed law revoking driver's licenses of repeat drunk driving offenders.
And we want to hear what you think. Do you support this bill or others for tougher penalties for chronic drunk drivers? Do you think this will actually make a difference? We'd like to hear your opinion at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're joined now by Melissa Dodder of the Marathon County Health Department to continue our discussion of the proposed Five Strikes OWI bill that was in hearing today at the Capitol. Melissa is a program coordinator for its drug-free communities. Melissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, some of the statistics on repeat drunk driving offenses are worth pointing out. 822 motorists were convicted of their fifth or greater OWI in the year 2014, 819 people in the year 2013. In Dane County and four other counties, repeat OWI convictions exceeded their previous five-year averages. Given some of the statistics like that, why are repeat OWI offenses such an issue in Wisconsin?
Well, I think that it really comes down to a variety of things. You know, when you look at drinking and driving or impaired driving, it's really a threat to everyone. And we've been really so accepting of it. You know, I've heard this examples of, you know, someone went to a wedding or someone went to an event or, you know, someone had a couple drinks and they're out for dinner and maybe had too much. You know, the likelihood of the person that gets picked up for drinking and driving, that being their very first time that they have consumed alcohol and then chose to get behind the wheel is slim to none. You know, it's something that is impactful. You know, we focus a lot on repeat offenses, but when you look at the statistics, majority of alcohol-related offenses are those that have no prior conviction. So, you know, while disproportionately those that have repeat offenses are involved in alcohol-related crashes often, which they're tragic for everybody that's involved, you know, we still have to remember that we need to not only focus on repeat offenders, but the first-time offenders as well.
Well, what do you think about this proposed legislation, the Five Strikes OWI?
You know, the thing that concerns me is that when somebody's getting up to that fifth offense, somebody's getting up to, you know, their third offense, even their fourth offense, there is a history of abuse there. There is a history of making this decision to, you know, consume alcohol, get behind the wheel. You know, majority of those, you know, it's estimated in the U.S. between a third and a half of those that get their first offense get a second offense at some point in their life. So, you know, we need to focus on not just those that are getting these multiple offenses, because it's very evident that there is something more to it than a bad decision. You know, it concerns me a little bit that with the mandatory sentencing, I don't see things that are linked with treatment. Putting somebody in prison for a minimum amount of sentencing may seem like it's a good penalty, but again, when you get to these offenses, it's more than just somebody saying, you know, I'm going to do it anyway. You know, I don't want to be the person on the other side, you know, in the other car when they're waiting to hit rock bottom. It's just, I'd like to see more in our state focusing on things like prevention, getting people before they even make that decision, as well as treatment for those that have a history of abusing alcohol and choosing to drive after doing so.
Now, Senator Wongard did name several sort of benchmarks that people would have to go through, including, sounds like, some treatment options to try to reapply for their licenses after that 10-year period elapsed where they didn't have their license. What did you think about that plan?
Well, I think that any time that you can incorporate treatment into any kind of treatment, you know, you're looking at mental health, substance abuse disorders, behavioral health in general, I think it's great. You know, I think that thinking of communities, you know, just where we live, you know, the access to the care that you need to address these issues is slim. Some counties have very few people that can really address these issues. So while it sounds good, we're trying to link people to treatment, we need to make sure that the treatment's there to be able for people to access.
We're going to go to our callers now. We have Bryce on the line in Decorah, Iowa. Bryce, hi.
Hi there. I was just, as I was driving along and I was hearing about the legislation, and it kind of, in my mind, I struck a parallel to gun control legislation and how there's often the argument against gun control legislation, particularly from the right side, saying, pardon me, saying that, you know, criminals don't follow the laws anyway. So, you know, if you make a law, you take away their guns, you take away their right to get guns, you know, they're not going to follow it anyway. They're going to still get guns. I think the same kind of holds true to this legislation. You take away their license, but you're not getting at the root of the problem, and therefore people are still going to get behind the car with or without a license, still, you know, intoxicated and still have the same issues. And so I think your current guest is absolutely right when we need to look more at solving the root of the problem.
And what do you think would solve the root of the problem? What would get at it?
You know, I think having people focusing more on rehabilitation side, I think there are, listening to the previous guest, there were some steps, there's some benchmarks in there, but it's almost, that's kind of almost too late. Five strikes seems like an awful lot when you're putting someone's life at risk when you get behind the wheel of a vehicle when you're intoxicated, you know.
Bryce, thank you so much for calling. And Melissa, what do you say to that?
I think Bryce is absolutely right. You know, when we look at this issue, there are proven strategies that can help us reduce the impact of drinking and driving. The most simple one, planning ahead. If you're going out to a wedding, if you're going to an event, if you're consuming alcohol, not in your own home, we need to remember a little moment here that alcohol-related falls hurt and kill much more people than alcohol-related car crashes. So it's not just drinking in your home is safer. But when you're going out, planning ahead, making sure somebody's ready that can, not just who's the most sober, but somebody that is absolutely 100% sober can take you home. Because even the small amount of alcohol can impair your judgment, can impair your reaction speeds, and so on. But this really is a community effort. We know that things like high visibility enforcement initiatives work. We know that things like having a minimum drinking age works. We know that things like ignition interlocks work. So, you know, I think we need to look at some of these proven strategies. What can the community do? Because until we all take personal accountability, we cannot keep looking at those that have most likely some sort of addiction and keep blaming this problem on them, because it's really all of us that are a part of it.
We're talking with Melissa Dotta right now. She's program coordinator for drug-free communities in Marathon County. And we're talking about a new Five Strikes OWI bill sponsored by Republicans that had a hearing today at the state capitol. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this new proposed legislation? Do you think this would get at the problem, curb those repeat habitual offenders? Or do you think it doesn't get at the root of it, as some of our callers suggested there? 800-642-1234. And Melissa, if you are writing the legislation, what kind of legislation would you like to see to address repeat drunken driving offenders?
You know, I think that when we look at the issue of drinking and driving and OWIs, and the more that we talk about impaired driving, which things like the senator said, you know, prescription drug abuse, heroin, marijuana use, yeah, we keep looking at those as, you know, who's the people that are already a problem for the system? You know, in my opinion, we need to invest more in preventing people from even making those decisions in the first place. We need to do more to make sure that if somebody is abusing alcohol or is abusing these substances, they are looking to quit, that we have something for them. We can't arrest our way out of this problem. Putting more people in prison or in jail, taking that burden and putting it on the correctional system is not going to be a long-term effective plan. I liken it to the duck in the dirty pond. We take it out, we clean it up, we put it right back in the same environment, in the right same community, in the same social circle, the family, what have you. We can expect the same results. And until we start embracing this issue from a community level, we're not going to be able to fully address it.
And can you give us a sense how Wisconsin legislation on this compares to other states?
Yeah, you know, when you look at it, there's a lot of focus always on repeat offenses. You know, the senator said, people say, why aren't we tougher on the first offense? And I really have to say, I dislike the idea of, oh, somebody went to a wedding and they got pinched or they got picked up in one of these stings or high visibility enforcements or whatever. You know, like I said, the first time offender, that is not normally necessarily or very even likely, that's the first time that they ever drove. There's some estimates that it's like 1 in 2,000. I've heard up to 2,000 times you may drive, somebody is driving while drinking and not getting pulled over. I mean, we don't have the enforcement we need to be able to arrest everybody that's drinking and driving. But until we start taking this more seriously and taking that personal accountability, I'm not saying we need to make it a felony for the first offense, but treating it the same as a traffic ticket or a seatbelt violation or a parking ticket is just not enough of a deterrent for people to not do it.
And in terms of the interlocks in Wisconsin, do you think that we use them enough?
You know, I think some of the things in the new bill that would allow for, that would more, not necessarily tie it to the vehicle, but tie it to the individual, I think some of that does have some merit. You know, I think ignition interlocks have been one of those proven strategies that communities can do to help reduce the burden of drinking and driving and operating while impaired. Yeah, I think that they are effective. I also know that they're very costly. But when you look at, I don't think people necessarily understand that when you get pulled over, it's not just your ticket. You're looking at assessments. You're looking at the interlock devices, depending on the circumstance. You're looking at loss of jobs. You're looking at loss of pay. You're looking at if you're possibly incarcerated. You know, there, it's a much bigger cost. You know, I've seen billboards and promotional things that it's, you know, an OWI is about a $10,000 ride home.
And we got to leave it there. Melissa, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Melissa Dotta, Program Coordinator for Drug-Free Communities in Marathon County, talking about a new Five Strikes OWI bill that had a hearing today at the state capitol.